I'm Tom Hall. Happy New Year, and welcome to Midday. Today, free speech on college campuses. A student suspended from a university in Oklahoma for statements his husband made on Facebook. Posters advertising Straight Pride Week ordered removed from bulletin boards in Ohio. And at a law school in Oregon, calls for a professor to resign when she wears blackface to a Halloween party to promote a conversation about race. Today on this archive edition of Midday, are trigger warnings and safe spaces in higher ed stifling intellectual thought and violating the Constitution? Our show has been pre-recorded, so we can't take your calls. The First Amendment in the Ivory Tower. That's coming up next on Midday after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Hall, and welcome to Midday. In 2013, before he ran for president or became a cabinet secretary, Ben Carson was a renowned brain surgeon at Johns Hopkins Hospital. Carson seemed a logical choice to deliver the commencement address at the medical school that year. But after he was invited to do that, he made comments on Fox News about marriage equality, saying in part, quote, "No group, be they gays, be they NAMBLA, be they people who believe in bestiality, they don't get to change the definition of marriage." Students and faculty demanded that Carson's invitation be rescinded. And Dr. Paul Rothman, the dean of the medical school, released a statement which said in part, quote, "Tension now exists in our community because hurtful, offensive language was used by our colleague, Dr. Ben Carson, when conveying a personal opinion. Dr. Carson's comments are inconsistent with the culture of our institution." Well, Carson withdrew from that event, and the incident helped propel him into the upper echelons of conservative celebrities. He now serves as the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in the Trump administration. So, in a country where we all have the right to unabridged freedom of speech, who gets to decide what comments are inconsistent with the culture of any institution? And who gets to decide what, if any, punishment should be the consequence of making such comments? So today on Midday, a conversation about free speech on America's college campuses. Ben Carson is one of hundreds of speakers, some conservative, some liberal, whose appearances on American campuses have been protested and canceled. Students often say that speakers with bigoted ideas threaten diversity and inclusion efforts at their schools. But like it or not, even hate speech is protected by the First Amendment. So perhaps the question is, what responsibility does a university have when it comes to protecting students from ideas they find offensive? Should schools create safe spaces where students can be assured that they won't be offended? Should those spaces be reserved for marginalized students and be kept separate from the larger student body? Should professors provide trigger warnings for class material that some may find disturbing? And if so, can it be done without infringing on free speech rights? Eugene Volokh is a law professor at UCLA, where he teaches and writes about free speech. He's the co-founder and lead blogger for the Volokh Conspiracy. It's an independent blog hosted by the Washington Post, and he joins us from his office in Los Angeles. Professor, welcome to the show.
Always good to be on.
Will Creeley is the senior vice president of legal and public advocacy for FIRE. That's the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. He joins us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Mr. Creeley, thank you.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And listeners, you are welcome to join us, too. I have a hunch that this is a topic that is of great interest to lots of folks. Our number here, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday at wypr.org. If you want to join us on Twitter, you can find us at Midday Tom Hall. So, Professor Volokh, the FBI just Monday of this week released new statistics about an uptick in incidents motivated by hate, motivated by bias against Jews, Muslims, LGBT people, and others. More than 6,100 reported incidents of hate crimes in 2016. That's up from 5,800 in 2015. So there's plenty of hate crimes, but hate speech and hate crimes don't necessarily go together. Hate speech is in fact protected by the First Amendment, is it not? And are there any kinds of speech that are not protected by the First Amendment? Give us a little law lesson to start us off.
Sure. There's no First Amendment exception for so-called hate speech, in part because there's no definition of hate speech. Hate speech has become a label that people throw around these days to cover everything from stuff that I think we'd all agree is hateful and evil, like Nazi advocacy, to basically criticisms of same-sex marriage or criticisms of homosexuality or criticisms of Islam or, for that matter, of devout Christianity or criticisms of illegal aliens and the like. All of that people have labeled hate speech. Sometimes they use that label about anti-abortion advocacy and the theory that it endangers the rights of women. So that label is something that is a rhetorical tool. It's not a legal concept. Now, there are certainly are exceptions to the First Amendment. They are narrow, well-established categories. For example, true threats of violence. If you were to say, I'm going to kill you, whether it's because of racial hostility or because you're just personally dislike them or because you feel that this person is a racist and you want to attack racists, threats of violence are constitutionally unprotected. Likewise, so-called incitement, which is intentional advocacy that is likely to lead to imminent lawless conduct, is constitutionally unprotected. The classic example, you're standing and exhorting a mob to go out there and burn down this draft office or abortion clinic or synagogue or anything where there is a risk that you're intentionally fanning of imminent illegal conduct. But that doesn't cover most general advocacy, and deliberately so. The Supreme Court deliberately crafted this as a very, very narrow exception. Speech is constitutionally protected against punishment and against government retaliation. Now, I should say that a lot of the things that people are talking about now aren't really about the First Amendment as such. So, for example, the disinvitation of Secretary Carson, I think, was a mistake for the university. But first of all, it's a private university, which isn't bound by the First Amendment. And second, it wasn't saying we refuse to allow him to speak on campus. It was saying that here he was given a particular position of honor as commencement speaker, and now we're going to withdraw that. We never had to give him this position in the first place. We'll withdraw it and substitute someone else, and then if some group wants to invite him to talk, he could be free to talk, assuming that that would be Johns Hopkins' position. And if that's so, then there wouldn't be a First Amendment problem even at a public university, because again, it's not somebody being barred from speaking generally, it's just being denied an invitation by the university itself. Now, again, it may be in various ways a bad idea. It may be rude to disinvite someone. It may be narrow-minded. But I think it's a very different matter from the university threatening to expel students who express a certain view or barring students from inviting speakers who want to express that view.
And Will Creeley, Professor Volokh does bring up the distinction between public and private universities, and the First Amendment applies directly to public institutions, not necessarily the case with private institutions. But your organization says that even though any restrictions on free expression certainly violate First Amendment protections for public universities, but they violate the sort of spirit of academic freedom and a commitment to academic freedom that private institutions should have. Are there any restrictions on speech that you think should be allowed?
Certainly, and I think Professor Volokh is right, as he often is. It's been my pleasure over the years to work with Professor Volokh in a variety of contexts, and he's very usefully laid out the problems here. It's my organization's position, and you can read all about it at thefire.org, that private universities that promise their students and faculty expressive rights need to honor those promises. Some private universities do not make those promises. Some sectarian institutions and some choose not to make those promises out of ideological or pedagogical commitments. But the vast majority of private universities advertise themselves as places where freedom of expression is celebrated and is the norm. So there's a sharp distinction, an important distinction, between First Amendment law, as Professor Volokh outlines it here, and the principles behind freedom of expression. Private universities that promise students those rights, we ask them to honor those promises, both as a matter of basic fair dealing and morality, but also in some states as a matter of contract.
And you've done work, Mr. Creeley, with your organization surveyed, and you find more than half of institutions of higher learning here in the United States are maintaining codes that you refer to as illiberal. In what way are they illiberal? Is there a common theme between all of them?
Sure. Quite often, the speech codes that we see in place at both public and private universities will allow for punishment of student or faculty speech that is subjectively offensive. That's quite a common theme. Other times there will be administrative hurdles to speaking one's mind on campus. For example, you will have to register with a university administrator before speaking in public or holding a demonstration. There will be no avenue for spontaneous speech, or you'll be confined to a tiny free speech zone. We think that those kinds of administrative hurdles or policies that restrict student expression on the basis of subjective disagreement are presumptively illiberal, and at the public universities, they quite often violate the First Amendment. Courts have held that for decades now. And at private universities, again, they contradict these promises that schools make to their students and faculty.
And Professor Volkoff, a colleague of yours, Erwin Chemerinsky, who's the dean of the UC Berkeley School of Law, wrote a book called Free Speech on Campus. It happens to be the exact same title of the book that our guest in the second part of the program has written. But he makes a distinction between a professional setting and a non-professional setting. Does the First Amendment apply differently if you say something in a college classroom or in your position as a college professor as opposed to on your personal Facebook page or in the park on a Saturday afternoon?
Well, I think, excuse me, I think the First Amendment does apply differently in some measure in the classroom, both to professor speech and to student speech. So, generally speaking, universities leave professors with a lot of flexibility about how to teach their classes. And I wouldn't relish my dean telling me, you know, Volok, when you teach First Amendment law, you need to teach these cases and not those cases. Or you need to talk to students in this way and not that way. But, you know, ultimately, when I am being paid to teach and to teach a group of students that the university has assembled for me, it seems to me the university, certainly within the First Amendment, would have considerable latitude to tell me, this is the stuff we want you to cover. This is what we think is pedagogically ineffective. We think if you use vulgarities, let's say, in your teaching, some people think it's fun and edgy. We think that it just turns off students, so you can't do that. This is something that I think the First Amendment would allow because I am speaking on behalf of the university in the classroom to students who are assembled for that purpose by the university and who will be graded and who will be given credit for that by the university. Likewise, my students don't have a lot of free speech rights in my classroom. If I find a student, for example, is saying something that's off topic, I'll tell him, you know, let's talk about it afterwards, and I may not call on him again. Or if a student says something that's insulting to his classmates, is personally insulting, I will admonish him. Because I want to create a helpful conversation within the class. So it's indeed in the classroom, there is a lot more guidance, a lot more control generally by me, but potentially also by the administration. Then there should be in, say, student newspapers or in conversations in the quad or when student groups invite speakers. Again, there are still academic freedom constraints. If my dean tells me, I don't want you to talk about arguments as to why this case is wrong. Our position is this case, the Supreme Court decision is right, and you shouldn't criticize it. I think even that would probably be consistent with the First Amendment. It just would be very bad for a university to do that sort of thing. So there are some academic ethics, professional ethics constraints there. But the First Amendment, I think, has relatively little to say, at least about faculty speech and about faculty control of speech within the classroom.
Mm-hmm. And Will Creeley, this distinction between academic freedom and freedom of speech guaranteed in the First Amendment, folks have pointed to the fact that there seems to be a generational divide side when Americans look at this issue. And they've pointed to a Brookings Institute study and some other studies, one I think done at UCLA, that suggests that current students today are less worried about infringement of free speech, and they seem to be more concerned with these safe spaces and people, you know, being respectful and unoffensive in their speech than generations prior to them. Is that how you interpret some of these results?
Well, I'll put it like this, Tom. I think civil libertarians like myself have an awful lot of work to do to educate everybody, not just young folks, but really people across the board about the importance of protecting expression that we don't like and the value of hearing opinions that we don't like, and making clear that the First Amendment has been a great protector of dissenters from all sides of the political spectrum. The great and unfortunately now late author and critic Nat Hentoff put it well in one of his book titles, Free Speech for Me, But Not for Thee. I think what some of the recent studies you reference demonstrate is that students see First Amendment rights being invoked by folks they don't like, whether that's white supremacist Richard Spencer, big banks, corporations, etc. As my boss Greg Lukianoff puts it, bigots, bullies, and robber barons seem to have been the most public faces of the First Amendment recently. So it's our job, both my organization, I think all of us as American citizens, to remind folks that the First Amendment has historically protected folks who have been denied political power, regardless of ideology, and it's incumbent upon us to make sure that the First Amendment remains as such. In short, the First Amendment needs some branding help lately.
Branding help, indeed. We will do a little bit more to decide what that brand should be when we come back. Will Creeley is a lawyer and the Senior Vice President of Legal and Public Advocacy for the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Eugene Volokh is a professor of law at the UCLA School of Law. Coming up, we'll add another law professor from the University of Pennsylvania to our conversation, and we will take your calls and emails. 410-662-8780, our email midday, wypr.org. You can find us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, it's the Midday Workout. We'll have tips on fending off those pounds that tend to pile on during the holidays with three fitness experts, personal trainer Sam Bassey and body pump teacher Julia No. They're going to be here along with Zumba instructor Tamara Fleming-Wimbish, and we'll talk about options for exercise. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will stop by with a review of Shakespeare in Love at Baltimore's Center Stage. That's all coming up tomorrow here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about free speech on college campuses and the tension between First Amendment rights and the need to create safe spaces for learning. Eugene Volokh is a professor of law at the UCLA School of Law, where he teaches this very subject. He's the co-founder and lead blogger for the Volokh Conspiracy. That's an independent blog published by the Washington Post. Will Creeley is the senior vice president of legal and public advocacy for the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE. And joining us on the line now from her office at the University of Pennsylvania, where she is a professor of education, philosophy, and political science, is Sigal Ben-Parath. She's the author of several books, including her latest, which is entitled Free Speech on Campus. Professor Ben-Parath, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be here.
You are welcome to join our conversation as well. 410-662-8780, our email midday at wypr.org, and our Twitter handle at Midday Tom Hall. So, Professor Ben-Parath, you talk about inclusive freedom as a necessary ingredient for a productive and fair climate on college campuses. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that, Tom, is that while clearly I'm in full agreement with the other speaker on the show, the other speakers, that the First Amendment has to be protected and that we need an open and free inquiry on campus in order to do our work, to do research and teaching, we also need to ensure that everybody gets to participate in the conversation. And listening to students' requests and demands, which are not always, you know, well-presented or well-formed, and sometimes they push too hard about specific speakers, et cetera. But what the students are telling us is that they want to make sure that all of their peers and all of the members of our campus can participate in the debate and in the open inquiry that we are promoting, and to prioritize inclusion and respect for diversity when we are protecting free speech is a central tenet of this requirement.
I'd like to play a clip from a gentleman named Cameron Okeke. He's a research assistant at the Urban Institute in Washington, and he graduated this past June with a master's in bioethics from the Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And he attended the University of Chicago as an undergraduate, and he was a senior when the dean of students there at the University of Chicago sent a letter to freshmen welcoming them to campus, saying that the university would not give trigger warnings and they would not provide safe spaces. He spoke with our producer, Bridget Armstrong, yesterday.
I think that the conversation about freedom of speech and safe spaces is missing an important aspect of what it actually feels like to have a community where you matter. So, like, I've been Black my whole life. I grew up in Chicago. I grew up in Illinois. There's lots of racial segregation. For a long time, and I'm a dark-skinned Black man, and for a long time, I felt really bad about myself and the way that I looked and the way that people perceived me. And I remember when we started this group. It was, like, called Safe Space, like, literally called Safe Space. And it was a Facebook group. That was all it was. And people were posting it about how their day was going or what they were struggling with. And it was basically a support group. It was essentially the safe space. It was a healing space. It was where people would talk about how hard their days were. People would make cookies and bring them to each other. And that was it. That was the entirety of it. And people just affirm things about each other. Like, your gender is real. Your sexual orientation is real. Like, your experience as a person with race is real, right? This space wasn't a radical space where we were planning die-ins and trying to, get the campus to, like, change these policies. It was a space where people just affirmed each other, and it was, like, one of the first spaces where that I have ever experienced that. And in my darkest of times, in the hardest of times at UChicago, and that place is pretty brutal, having people just simply be like, you know, you're great, or you're beautiful, or your skin's wonderful, and like that experience, even online, not even in person, we became friends in person, was amazing.
So Will Creeley, here's a guy going to the University of Chicago as an undergraduate, talking about it as a brutal environment and needing a place where he can, you know, get out of that brutal environment, if only for a brief respite. What's the problem with that? Is there a problem?
There's no problem with that, Tom. And I had the pleasure of meeting Cameron at a symposium organized by PEN America at the National Constitution Center here in Philadelphia last year at around this time. And Cameron's exceptionally bright, and he raises really good points in this excerpt. I also encourage your listeners to check out a great piece he wrote at Vox.com about safe spaces. The first and most important point I want to make about safe spaces is that I think the debate often is misconstrued here. Safe spaces are actually protected by the First Amendment. If students voluntarily form safe spaces while they're exercising their freedom of assembly right, they can get together and form a private group and engage in exactly the kind of affirmation that Cameron so usefully describes here. The only time safe spaces present a problem for free speech on campus is when they're used as a sword to control what others may say in public spaces and forums. If you have a private group that is providing you with refuge from the demands or stresses of college life, well, that's, you know, that's voluntary association at its finest. That's a great thing, whether that's an affinity group for your church or a group based around your other identities, or even just a group of beleaguered Baltimore Ravens fans for your audience. You know, I mean, that's fine, and that's to be celebrated. The problem is when people start saying, well, this entire campus is a safe space, so we can't hear from that person with that idea. That's particularly a problem at public campuses.
Mm-hmm. And Eugene Volk, is that the deal here? I mean, it's basically safe spaces are okay. It's just a matter of what the size of the space should be. Is the university obligated to make the entire campus safe for everybody?
You know, the safe space is another term like hate speech that nobody really defines, right? So literally, most people, I think, before they heard about safe spaces, probably thought safe means nobody should be physically attacked. Maybe nobody should be actually threatened with violence, which the law generally does treat as comparable to physical attack, of course universities should be safe spaces under that definition. But if the argument is that this should be a place that is safe from criticism, safe from people saying things that make you feel bad, well, then I think Will is completely right these are the kinds of spaces we build for ourselves often. You might say, at my home, that's the way we want to operate. Over at dinner, I'm not going to invite people who are going to make their fellow guests feel bad. At the breakfast table, I'm going to teach my kids to behave well. So that's perfectly sensible. But when it comes to the university as a whole, of course people should be free to say things that do make other people feel bad, such as, I think that fundamentalist Christianity is a danger to women, to gays, and to the planet. You know, fundamentalist Christians would say, wait a minute, you are challenging something that is so critical to my identity. Well, I'm sorry, but this is my view, and if you want to debate it, you're fine. If you don't want to debate it, fine. But you can't silence me. You can't suppress this speech, threaten to expel me because I'm making you feel bad about it. The same thing is true, what's true of fundamentalist Christianity and criticism of it. It's true of Islam. It's true, it seems to me, of homosexuality. It's true of various claims about gender identity. People need to be able to discuss all issues, including issues that have to do with religion, with race, with sex, with sexual orientation, with politics. And if we try to make universities safe spaces in the sense that people are safe from having to hear things that they find offensive to aspects of their identity, then we're losing the value of the university as a place where ideas can be debated, including ideas about these very important topics.
And Professor Ben Parathen, when it comes to shielding people from ideas that might offend them, when it comes to the size of the safe space, let's look at the individual classroom. You write in your book that you have no problem with trigger warnings. Is that the key? Is that the solution to keeping spaces safe? I mean, I suppose if you're in a class, you could make the argument that you've chosen to take that class, although perhaps if you're in a particular major, you're obligated to take that class. You show up in a classroom and then you're hearing ideas that you don't agree with or that are offensive to you. How do trigger warnings inside an individual classroom function?
Well, trigger warnings get mixed up in this conversation for no good reason, and I really think the University of Chicago in its letter was mixing up all sorts of pedagogical methods and then conceptual ideas that had nothing to do with each other. And the faculty at the University of Chicago, who responded with rejecting the demand to avoid trigger warnings, were quite right. I mean, what kind of a teacher am I if my goal is to spring on you ideas to surprise you with something that's going to maybe make you reject my views just because you were unprepared or not ready to think about them in a productive manner? I don't see why trigger warnings even are a part of this conversation, right? They are just a productive pedagogical tool that people use in order to have a more inclusive and more productive conversation. But more broadly, I think that the other two esteemed colleagues on this in this conversation are actually failing to recognize that what people like Cameron and others who are concerned about the issue of safe spaces, what they are actually calling for us to do is to understand that they are not looking to shield themselves from the intellectual engagement. What they are asking for is not intellectual safety. They are asking for dignitary safety. In other words, they are trying to work, study, do research, live in a context where they are not constantly questioned as members of the campus community. In the case of the wonderful student who you just had the excerpt from, you know, being at the University of Chicago, he's saying, as a dark-skinned African-American man, is brutal. Why is it brutal? It's because he feels continuously, I assume, right, that he feels continuously questioned. can you be an equal member of this conversation? Do we even have any reason to listen to what you're saying? The kind of safety that I'm looking for, both in my classrooms and overall on my campus, is dignitary safety, which doesn't preclude raising questions like Eugene Wallach was just suggesting. It doesn't preclude it, but it does require me to create the kind of climate that would support my students, including fundamentalist Christians or transgender or black men or whatever the context is, including all of them feeling that they can actually be respected in participating in the conversation. And you couldn't just in a flip way say, well, safe spaces undermine that. No, they don't if they are properly construed.
And Will Creeley, your organization publishes a list. They keep a database of people who have been invited to campus. Now we're talking not just about the classroom, perhaps, but perhaps campus-wide addresses. Everybody from Donald Trump Jr. To even one of our guests, Mr. Volkoff himself, has had problems. It has been disinvited from speaking. There are people, you categorize them as protests that come from the left or from the right. They include the Dalai Lama. They include Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education. They include Milo Yiannopoulos, who's on the list a lot. He seems to make a cottage industry of being disinvited from making speeches. That's a pretty good gig, actually. When it comes to that, we have an email from Myra, who says, are universities allowed to distinguish between speakers that are basing views on fact via scholarship and those that may not? Will Creeley, what do you think?
That's a great question. I think at a public university, that is the job of students and faculty who come to hear the speaker. I think there is a value with confronting what one perceives as error with what one perceives as truth. My advice to students who have a speaker with whom they disagree come to campus is to either ignore it if it's feels as though it's a waste of time or simply designed to provoke, as I think some of the recent campus events involving, for example, Richard Spencer have been pretty clearly designed to do.
Yeah, and in an academic sense, does a Richard Spencer or an Ann Coulter have anything to add to the conversation about race or anything?
That's a question for students and faculty, right? You don't have to go to the event, but if you do go to the event, and I advise students to do this all the time, and you disagree with the speaker, wait till the Q&A and challenge them. And if you don't feel like engaging with them on that note, stand outside and protest. What I would strongly discourage them from doing is trying to silence them by storming the stage or denying them the right to speak. I think in so doing, there are two considerations. First of all, I think that you are elevating their ideas and giving them more cachet than they otherwise might have, right? Come hear the speaker that was too dangerous for this campus, et cetera. Sometimes provocateurs love that kind of attention. It helps them establish their own brand or credentials among their supporters. But the other point is that even in hearing somebody with whom you strongly disagree, you may learn something about their worldview that either strengthens your own or perhaps changes your own. I think about Lee Bollinger, the president of Columbia University, who invited former Iranian president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad to Columbia's campus. And Ahmadinejad spoke and said something like, there are no gay people in Iran. And I think that for the students there, they got a very clear example of just how tenuous Ahmadinejad's sense of his own country was, you know, about how he was perhaps living in a different reality. And that can be an insight that would not have been gained had he been simply banned from campus. And the last point I'll make, Tom, is that once this no platforming idea has been introduced, once universities and student bodies start saying, okay, this speaker is too controversial, this speaker isn't, it's very hard to cabin that to only speakers with whom one subjectively agrees or disagrees. My organization has fought these kinds of attempts from both the left and the right, everybody, as you say, from Charles Murray to Bill Ayers. Nobody at some point is pure enough. Everybody will find somebody something not to like about an invited speaker. So better to hear it all and challenge, sit it out, protest, what have you, but to answer speech with more speech.
Will Creeley is the Senior Vice President of Legal and Public Advocacy for FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. He joins us from WHYY in Philadelphia. Eugene Volokh is a professor of law at the UCLA School of Law. He's on the phone from his office in L.A. And Sigal Ben-Parath is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Her latest book is called Free Speech on Campus. She's on the phone from Pennsylvania as well. More when we return. I will do my best to allow some of our callers to exercise their right of free speech. Our number here, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us. Welcome back, everybody. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about free speech, hate speech, restricted speech, all kinds of speech. In a 2015 survey at Yale University, 72% of students supported disciplinary action against anyone on campus who uses language that is considered offensive. So is it within the rights of the university to punish speech that is offensive? And is it within someone's constitutional rights to utter that kind of speech? Of course, according to the First Amendment, it is. Our guest today, Eugene Volokh. He's a professor of law at the UCLA School of Law and the co-founder and lead blogger for the Volokh Conspiracy, an independent blog published by the Washington Post. Will Creeley is the senior vice president of legal and public advocacy for FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. And Sigal Ben-Parath is a professor of education, philosophy, and political science at the University of Pennsylvania. She's the author of Free Speech on Campus. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to join us on Twitter, as dozens and dozens of people have decided to do, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to the phones. Chris in Towson, thanks for your patience. Welcome to Midday.
Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to say, listening to this conversation as a student at Towson University, I feel I really have to agree with Dr. Ben-Parath. I think that there is missing a portion of this discourse, where we respect the rights of the students to refuse to be subjected to the kinds of dialogue or the kind of dialogue that is promoted by speakers such as, Richard Spencer, such as Milo Yiannopoulos. I feel like we have to defer to the students in cases like this. And I feel like protests at universities being cracked down on by possibly police is, not necessarily a productive part of protecting protecting speech.
Well, thanks for the call, Chris. I appreciate it. And Eugene Volokh, perhaps some of it comes down to a question of how the authority of what the climate on a campus is going to be is distributed. Is it up to the administration to say, okay, here's the deal, here's the climate that we want to have attract students that are, comfortable in that climate? Or is it the obligation of the university to say, okay, students, we need your voices heard when it comes to developing this whatever particular culture we might have on our campus? What do you think?
Well, I don't think this is the right alternative at all. What I don't hear, there is an alternative that says, university says to student groups, you can invite whatever speakers you want, and other student groups can invite their speakers they want, and they can express opposition to existing speakers without shouting them down and the like, and then everybody is free to hear what they want to hear, and if they don't want to show up to one of these things, they don't have to show up. It's this, the speaker's call. The caller was talking about, I'm not sure exactly words to use, but basically how he as students should be free from being subjected to this. Well, I don't think he's subjected to a Milo speech, which goes on in some meeting in some classroom, which he isn't present at. What he is subjected to is knowing that somebody on campus is saying things he dislikes. And I think the answer should be, at the university, there will always be people saying things that you dislike. And the solution to that is invite speakers you agree with, or just ignore the speakers you disagree with, if that's
if that's what you want to do. Remember, this isn't just about Milo. This is about Heather McDonald, who is criticizing the Black Lives Movement and whose speeches have been attempts to shut her down. She is a well-known journalist and researcher. This is about students shouting down a speaker, a prominent scholar of modern Turkish history, who had a biography of Kemal Ataturk. These speakers, who are essentially an Armenian extremist group, basically stopped him from speaking because they disapprove of Ataturk, quite possibly for very good reasons, but that's not a basis for shutting down speech at universities. Once you get in a position where you say, well, either students or the administration is entitled to change, to set the climate at the university by excluding speech that they feel contributes to a bad climate, that basically means that dissenting voices on a vast range of topics are going to be excluded, and you're not going to have any real meaningful public debate on these issues at a university. How can you have a debate on affirmative action or illegal immigration or extremist Islam without some students being in a position where they feel that their dignity has been undermined? Well, that's what universities are all about, is people expressing views, even in ways that, and even on subjects that many people find offensive.
And Sigal Ben-Porath, you write in your book about this dignitary harm that minority students often feel. And you also note that administrations are often much more concerned with keeping the peace and keeping civility, perhaps, than they are with freedom of speech. Maybe peace and quiet shouldn't be such an ideal?
Peace and quiet are definitely not an ideal. And I think it's very important, as Mr. Volokh is saying, it's very important to protect and support the voicing of dissenting opinions. And clearly, I'm not recommending or supporting the heckler's veto, right, or the efforts by students to shut down speech from these different speakers that were just mentioned. But I do think it's still important to recognize that at this time of growing extremism and growing polarization in our public sphere, to just say, let the truth come out by having anybody come on campus and speak, and you may feel free to ignore that, I just don't think it's a sufficient response. Clearly, censorship or the heckler's veto are not appropriate responses, right? Because we do want to have an environment where an open debate is possible. But I don't think that burying our heads in the sand and saying, look, you know, people can invite whoever they want, and if you don't like what they say, you may ignore it or you may ask tough questions. This is treating the universities as they were maybe many years ago, or as they are in some ideal version of our lives. This is not what is happening right now. I'm chairing at Penn the Committee on Open Expression, which is responsible for adjudicating and taking care of many of these speech issues. We did have, by the way, Heather McDonald speak on our campus just recently, and she did, manage to get her speech and her conversation with the students across as she expected. And we did have some significant protest, which went along, as they should as well, because the protesters have a view too that needs to be protected and supported. So I don't think that the push to bring more extreme, more polarizing voices on campus and just to let them, you know, to have their moment in the sun on campus, I don't think this is a sufficient response. I think campuses have a more significant responsibility to their students and to the truth, right? Both of which are dimensions of our key efforts here and our key mission. And so we should take this responsibility seriously rather than just shielding ourselves by saying, well, it's First Amendment and free speech and anyone can say what they want or listen to what they choose to listen. It's just not enough.
Let's go back to the phones. Tim in Frederick, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Thank you. I just wanted to propose a somewhat of a counterpoint. How do we address the person who is personally offended and hurt when people suggest that their rights to speech, especially in clubs or sort of social gatherings, even if they're on campus, it should be limited. I mean, if it personally offends and hurts me to hear that my speech should be limited, is it okay to say that speech suggesting the limitation should be banned on sort of the same logical grounds as banning other speech that we find offensive?
Well, Eugene Volokh, I mean, when it comes to whether or not free speech can be banned, that has been decided in the Constitution, has it not?
Well, certainly the Supreme Court has decided this as to public institutions, but there certainly could be a legitimate debate about whether how we should interpret the First Amendment. But returning, I think the caller makes an excellent point. It seems to me when people are talking about protecting people's dignitary interests from being injured, they're not really talking about all people. They have no trouble injuring the dignitary interests of people they see as, say, politically benighted. They have no trouble often saying rude things about Republicans or about, as I mentioned before, fundamentalist Christians. They can talk about white privilege, about how whites are responsible for all of these bad things. And, you know, maybe they're right. Maybe whites are responsible for these bad things. Maybe Republicans are benighted. But the whole point is that that kind of speech, everybody agrees, needs to be protected because even if it's offensive, even if it's wrong, it's something that needs to be aired. But the same thing is true of all groups. It's not like there should be some groups whose dignity doesn't matter and others whose dignity does matter. It's that all speech should be protected, even when it is challenges some people's identity attributes. And, of course, others should be able to criticize it. And likewise, we hear talk about protecting dissent, and I'm all in favor of protecting dissent, but then we hear, oh, but these extremist divisive speakers, well, they don't belong at universities. They are dissenters. There are many things that are very bad about a lot of these speakers, but they certainly are dissenting from the orthodoxy, the correct orthodoxy of racial equality, of religious toleration and such. They're saying, we dissent from this. We think this orthodoxy is wrong. Now, it may be the orthodoxy is right and they're wrong, but if you're trying to suppress them, you are trying to suppress dissent. That's what you're trying to do. It's just that you're saying, well, certain kinds of dissent we want to promote and certain kinds you want to suppress. I think the better view should be that all this speech should be protected. No groups should be immune from criticism or have criticism of them suppressed in the name of protecting dignity. And the way to deal with speech that you think is bad is by responding to it or sometimes ignoring it and not trying to suppress it on the grounds that this is bad dissent and we like our good dissent.
And Will Creeley, I'm going to give you the last word here. You have an initiative called the Stand Up for Speech Litigation Project, and you're actually suing universities that have free speech codes or speech codes that you don't think are constitutional. Tell us briefly about that.
Tom, thanks so much for bringing it up. I was just going to do the same in response to the caller's excellent point about subjectivity and the discussion between my two esteemed colleagues here. In 2015, we sponsored a lawsuit against Western Michigan University, where the chief of police had decided that rapper and social activist Boots Riley was too dangerous for campus without expensive security to be charged to the Kalamazoo Peace Center, the student group that wished to bring Mr. Riley to campus because of his role in the Occupy movement. And I think that's a useful example of the ways in which the idea of extremism or who is too dangerous for campus can be weaponized on both sides of the ideological divide.
And Will, I got to give you about 10 seconds. We're running out of time here.
Great. Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to participate.
All right. Appreciate all of you participating in our conversation. Will Creeley from FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Eugene Volokh from UCLA School of Law, and Sigal Ben-Parath from Penn. Lunch today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the Square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches, and we are grateful to them. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, the midday workout. We'll give you some tips about staying fit and maintaining your workout routine in between the holiday feasts and parties. So that's it for us today. Thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned for Future City with Wes Moore after the news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.